Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers find that they cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within the narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Michael Van Beek, the Director of Research at the Mackinac Center, and your host for today. Today, we're going to look at some very unique periods in history when the Overton Window seems to have shifted dramatically. This typically happens as a result of a major event of some kind, like a revolution or a regime change. And in this podcast, we'll look at what happened when Poland and Estonia experienced major changes in the 80s and 90s, when these countries shifted from socialism to a market-based economy. Joining me to talk about this on the Overton Window podcast is Matt Mitchell. Matt is a senior fellow at the Fraser Institute and co-author of two books about Poland and Estonia's transition from socialism to capitalism. So, welcome, Matt.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Matt, can you set the stage for us here of the story of Poland and Estonia transforming in such a dramatic way? What's the history behind these countries' experiments with socialism?
Yeah, absolutely. So these are both countries that were essentially dragooned into the Soviet sphere. Estonia was actually annexed to the Soviet Union illegally as part of the Nazi-Soviet pact. And Poland was brought into the Soviet orbit also as part of the Nazi-Soviet pact, though they managed to maintain be a satellite state rather than a satellite puppet state rather than actually part of the Soviet Union. But in both cases, the Soviet Union imposed socialism on them. And so, the government took over the means of control of the industry. They abolished private property, productive property. In many cases, they took even private personal effects, stealing bicycles and cars. And in the case of Estonia, they took over people's homes, forced collective housing on the people. Also in the case of Estonia, they took over farms and forced collectivization at the point of a gun, that people were, some 60,000 Estonians were exiled because they were resisting collectivization. So these were, basically both forced to be, totalitarian socialist states. And then in the 80s and 90s, they managed to break free. And what both of them achieved is really quite remarkable. In the case of Poland, they were one of the first to sort of break free, and they managed to eliminate price controls, privatize, they balanced the budget, they simplified and flattened the tax system, they required the Central Bank of Poland to, focus on controlling inflation. And in the case of Estonia, they managed even, further reaching reforms. Again, reducing spending and balancing the budget, but they also introduced the world's first personal flat tax. They unilaterally eliminated all barriers to trade, which is just remarkable. I have to underline that, like, unilaterally eliminating barriers to trade is just like not something that happens in the modern world. They reduced regulations and made it easier to start a business, privatized, cleaned up government, made it one of the cleanest governments actually in the world. They have a corruption perception index that is comparable to Canada's, which is actually and cleaner than the United States. The United States has a higher corruption perception than Estonia. And they managed to, make themselves one of the freest economies in the world. So they're both really pretty remarkable stories in terms of where they were and where they have come.
Yeah, I'd like to focus a little bit on how that shift happened. Like, how did they evolve from a totalitarian socialist regime to one where they, the society, the people in general, embraced these much different types of policies, right? Market-based type of policy. So how did that get started? How did it get instigated? Who was involved?
Yeah. So, I think at the heart of it is one thing you have to talk about here is just the failure of the socialist experiment. So, and the best way to evaluate that is based on the goals of the socialists themselves. So they were quite explicit about this, Marx and Engels, as well as Lenin and Stalin and their successors. They claimed that socialism would outcompete capitalism. They claimed that it would create material prosperity. We all remember the famous example of Khrushchev pounding his shoe on the desk of the United Nations, and he's saying, "We will bury you." That was not a militaristic threat. That was his empirical claim that socialism would simply outcompete capitalism, leave it in the dustbin of history. And so they believed that it would be a superior economic system because it would get rid of duplicative, competition, and it would allow, through central planning, everybody to kind of move in the same direction. And the actual, evidence of that is just not there. So, it's quite clear by the 1970s and early 80s that it just wasn't living up to that promise. The best estimates suggest that in, for example, the average of all former Soviet states, they were making, something like 30% of the income of Western capitalist societies, right? Rampant shortages in all sorts of goods, meat especially, but cookware and clothing and of course apartments. People were waiting decades to find housing. You could see this in terms of the access to goods. The typical in the typical communist state or socialist state, they simply had far fewer cars, far fewer appliances. They had to work many times longer in order to afford basic goods and services, three times as long to buy a chicken, almost four times as long to buy sugar and butter, and five times as long to get gas or soap or egg, six times as long for eggs. So just it was very obvious that the system wasn't working. And then the other, remember the other claim, which is the one that we probably are more likely to remember of socialism, is that it would create equality. And this too was so obviously wrong at that point. That it was hard for anybody to believe in the system. The elite, the nomenklatura, they could shop in their own shops that had access to Western goods that nobody else had. They were able to hunt in their own private hunting grounds, go to their private spas. They were allowed passports when nobody else was allowed passports. They didn't have to pay taxes when everybody else had to pay taxes. That was something that was kept a state secret. So I think the beginning of the story of how this happened has to start with the abject failure of socialism and the obvious, that obvious fact, which was so clear to everybody. And then in terms of the real mechanics of it, I think one way to characterize it is in the case of Poland, the revolt really began as a labor revolt. And that's important because remember, socialism and communism are supposed to be for the worker, right? So what happened is this really loyal socialist worker named Anna Walentynowicz, she saw one of her bosses stealing money. And so she did, as a loyal socialist, she reported it. And rather than being commended, she was fired. And this took place in the on a Stalin the Stalinist shipyard, and they the her fellow workers, this was in 1981, her fellow workers were just so appalled that they went on strike. And this is also importantly, in the case of Poland, at the time, the new the Catholic Church had selected a Pole to be the new Pope, Pope John Paul II. And so he visited Poland. He visited with these workers. He told them, be not afraid. He was very careful to go, right up against the line of opposing the socialist regime, but not crossing it. So he would say things like, be not afraid. And it was obvious to everybody who exactly they should be afraid of, or they might be afraid of. And then he said things like, have solidarity. And so, as a result of, partially him saying this, the organizers of the strikes organized the world's first union that was outside the of the first sorry the first union in a socialist state that was not organized by the state. And so, it was the first independent union. It was known as Solidarity, picking up on the Pope's words. And within a year, one out of every three Poles was a member of the Solidarity Union. And so they start agitating. And what's called the Long December Night, the Soviets crack down on them. December 14th, they arrested, you know, thousands of people, including, you know, just ridiculous things like, you know, one person got several years in jail for, he was a train conductor and he pulled the cord to sound, to do the, to toot the train for 30 seconds or something like that in support of the Solidarity Movement. And for that, he ended up getting several years in jail. And when they came for the leaders of this organization, the Solidarity, including Lech Walesa, he said, this is the nail in the coffin of communism. This is your last, this is your moment of failure. And at the time, it looked like he was wrong. You know, this was, it seemed like the state was fighting back with a vengeance, but he ended up being right. You know, within a few years, the regime had completely lost its support. There was a new leadership in the Soviet Union that was not really going to countenance invading Poland if it adopted reforms. And so they managed to actually, you know, gain their independence. And in the case of Estonia, we can go into greater detail there too. But I think one thing that's important maybe to remember is that the very first protests were environmental protests. And so here you have, again, two pillars of what I think a lot of people today think of as the goals of socialism is equality and workers and the environment. Well, the socialist record on the environment was absolutely atrocious. They had dug up all of this phosphate. Often it was tainted with highly radioactive material, and they just dumped it in the ground where it was seeping into waterways and into and catching fire, polluting the air. And the Soviet record on the environment was just absolutely awful. And they had plans to do further phosphate mining. Now, of course, if it were subject to a capitalist, profit incentive, they would have never done the phosphate mining because it was worthless phosphate. The juice wasn't worth the squeeze. But the socialist central plan called for doing the mining, and so they had to do the mining. And so the people, it was known as the in 1987, it was known as the phosphate spring, and they protested. And this was partially strategic. You know, they were protesting the broader regime, but they also knew that if they started the protest on a technical issue like the environment, not politics, not necessarily about the legitimacy of socialism or the legitimacy of the annexation of Estonia, but just phosphate mining, they kind of thought this was a good way to test. And they were testing in some ways Gorbachev's promise of openness, glasnost. And so they tested it, and to their surprise, they won. The Soviets actually backed down and didn't pursue any further phosphate mining. And this sort of started this process of, okay, now we're going to protest the illegal annexation of Estonia in the Nazi-Soviet pact. And now we're going to protest socialism itself and speak openly about that. And so they kind of pushed it over a series of the next several years. We can get into the details of the final break in 1991, which is kind of an exciting story. But I think it's, you know, important to start with the idea that, you know, really the protest began because socialism was not living up to its promises.
Yeah, it's so a little bit of a
short question.
No, well, that's, you're covering several decades of history there. So it sounds like they were mugged by reality, as you might say, yeah. A little bit, where the outcome of the socialist regimes just weren't producing the kinds of things that they were promising. I wonder how much support did the socialist governments in those countries have from the people themselves, or were they sort of always pushing for more market-like reforms? And the reason they were stayed socialist for decades was just because they were trapped into it essentially by the Soviets, or was there local organic support for these regimes in Estonia and Poland?
Yeah, so I mean, it's somewhat hard to say because Of course, you don't have, freedom of press. You're not allowed to do a poll or anything. The best estimates are that in all of Estonia, there were maybe a couple hundred communists, homegrown original communists. Poland is harder to say, but there probably was a little bit greater support. I think it's basically fair to say that there was very little support for the regimes. And in both countries, one of the things that ended up happening is the local communist leaders, or the local socialist leaders, often actually played a helpful role trying to resist the center, trying to resist Moscow, and trying to protect the locals a little bit. I think that's something that I think was maybe not always appreciated at the time. But, in trying to stave off collectivization of farms, for example, local Estonian political leadership, really resisted it. Ultimately, they were sacked and replaced with Russian leadership for that. So, always sort of simmering under the surface, I think there was quite a bit of resistance. One way you can see this is the remarkable story of the Estonian Forest Brothers. So, for most of the world, World War II ended in 1945. But not for the Baltics. In the Baltic states, starting in Estonia, but then also in Latvia and Lithuania, young men went to the forest. And they, in troops as small as one or two, or as large as, 50 or 60, they formed what were known as the Forest Brothers. And they continued to resist the Soviet occupation. Whenever the Soviets were trying to do deportations or take private property or force collectivization or force arrests, they would try to stop it. And remarkably, the very last Estonian Forest Brother passed away in 1978. So, we hear of these stories of people in the Pacific, fighting World War II for decades later. There was actually this guy, August Sabe, fighting the Soviet Union until 1978. And he was the Soviets found out about him. They went to investigate. They posed as fishermen. They even took their pictures with him. And then they arrested him. And he, or tried to arrest him. He jumped in the river. They jumped in after him and they wrestled with him and they got him out and he said, okay, I surrender. And they took the cuffs off and he jumped back in the river and drowned. And we don't know whether it was an accident or whether they drowned him themselves. My favorite version of the story is that he purposely lodged himself under a log, wanting to be the master of his own destiny to the end. But who knows? So that kind of resistance, I think, is really important because it ends up being a part of what, how they managed to make such a free society afterwards.
Yeah, and that's another aspect that I'm really interested in is the transition from socialist organization to a market-based economy. Was that, I mean, it seems like that's a massive and sudden shift, but how did that go over in these countries in this case? Was it very difficult? Were there a lot of growing pains, transitional costs, and those sorts of things, or did it go smoother than what people expected?
So it absolutely was difficult. There's no question about that. In all of the Soviet Union and all of the satellite states, unemployment skyrocketed after the fall of communism. One way to put it is, as my co-author Pete Beck puts it, is just think about what was happening in these countries at the time. The typical worker at the time got up and went to the wrong job in the wrong place in the wrong industry. And that's what socialism does, right? Because it doesn't operate on the signals of price, profit, and loss, and what customers actually want. And so, as a result, people were not creating a lot of value. So once that system goes away, you have people who are 40 or 50 years old, and they're trained to do something that nobody wants them to do. They're not creating any value for customers. And so it is going to be painful, and it was painful. Now, here's the interesting thing. So you're probably familiar with the term the Washington Consensus, and this was the basic idea at the time of what needed to be done. And it really was a consensus. It was, well, you got to move towards a more market economy. You have to reduce spending. You have to have lower taxes with a broader tax base. You have to focus on getting rid of subsidies for particular firms or industries and just focus on a general social safety net. You need to have monetary policy that's more normal, sound monetary policy without this, get rid of this rampant inflation. Need to cut tariffs and have a rule of law. So this was generally pretty well accepted. What was truly debated at the time was how fast they should go. And so there were people who were, believed that what they needed to do was just it was going to be too hard of a transition, and so we need to go it slow, and that way you can adjust if things go wrong. And there were other people, like Jeff Sachs at Harvard, who said, look, trying to go slow or partially is like switching from driving on the right-hand side of the road to the left-hand side of the road, one car at a time, or just starting with trucks and then later moving to car to passenger cars. And so you should just do it all at once. I think at this point the evidence is pretty clear empirically that those countries that moved quicker and more ambitiously actually fared better. So the contrast between Estonia and Poland here is a good example. At the time, a lot of people thought Poland was moving real quick. They didn't move all that quickly. Estonia really did move quickly. And the evidence, the proof is in the pudding. Estonia now has the lowest poverty rate of any formerly socialist country. It has the highest per capita GDP of any formerly socialist country. It has more startups than any other country in Europe, more unicorn startups than any other country in Europe. That's startups that are valued over $1 billion. Household names like Skype are Estonian companies. And this is just one example, but if you do cross-country careful empirical analyses, as a number of professors have, like the professors Greer have done, you'll find that it's pretty consistent. Those countries that moved quicker and faster actually did better.
That suggests that there's some underlying support or familiarity with operating in a market-based system. I mean, as you said, there were people who'd spent decades trying to operate under the Soviet system, and they were able. I mean, it's really remarkable that they could successfully transition that quickly, which suggests there must be some something that was never lost amongst the people, even during those socialist decades, that they knew how to sort of switch back to a market-based economy relatively quickly. Is that, I mean, how do you think about that? Is that your view, sort of?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's hard to know because we're only, you can't run a controlled experiment, and so we're sort of grasping here and guessing. But I do think that's probably some of it. Estonia had been an independent country for only 19 years, after they had basically gained their independence from the Soviet Union, from Russia, and then in 1920, and then they were forced back in 1939. And during that time period, they did develop a bit of a reputation as an entrepreneurial society. They also, though, it's interesting to note, it's not like the government was great during that time of independence. It's sometimes called sort of creeping mild authoritarianism. And so one way to put it, I think, is they sort of knew that this was a second chance. They might not have done it right the first time, and they probably weren't going to get a third chance. So, and the 1920s and 30s were recent enough in the 1990s that many people had a working memory of it. And so there was this idea that, yeah, we need to try it, but we can't get it wrong this time. And in terms of the ideas of actual, market oriented, this is kind of fascinating. The first democratically elected prime minister was Mart Laar. He was a very unassuming former history teacher. The fact that he was a history teacher is important. He had, one of the things that had led to the independence of Estonia was just speaking the truth about their history and about the fact that they had been illegally annexed by the Soviet Union. And he was one of the people who led that. But he didn't know that much about economics. And he was unassuming and would say, I the first I heard of economics was I'd heard about this terrible, awful Western economist that the Soviets hated named Milton Friedman. And I thought, gee, if the Soviets think this guy is so awful, he must be pretty good. And so I managed to get a hold of a legal cop an illegal copy of one of his books, and I read it. He read Capitalism and Freedom, and he thought that this was just normal economics. He thought, well, I assume this is what the United States has already implemented. They've implemented all this. And so when he took over, he just went about doing that, thinking that that was just normal in some ways. And so I think that's kind of the interesting environment in which it happened, is that it's not like it was necessarily, all these people who were steeped in free market economics. It was, Mart Lahr and a few colleagues who kind of thought this was just the normal thing to do. And I, again, they were supported, I think, in part because everybody else felt, well, whatever the Soviets had done, we got to do exactly the opposite of that.
Yeah, now I wonder too how much they could have looked at the rest of Europe and the experience that those countries had post-war. I mean, by the 80s, like you said, there was probably a pretty clear divide between the experiences of the more capitalist countries in Western Europe compared to those on the other side of the Iron Wall.
Yeah, I think that's really important, especially because, and it's also, important for your listeners who are thinking about reforms in, maybe not formally socialist states, but places where I'm from, New Mexico, which are we've got our problems, right? And Michigan too, right? So,
Sure.
these are one of the things that was really powerful was to have an example, to have a proof of concept. And so, in the case of Estonia, they had Finland. So right after the Soviets took over Estonia, they tried to take over Finland. And the Finns famously donned skis and fought back in the Winter War, and they won. It was a difficult victory insofar as they had to concede quite a bit to the Soviets. They had to give away a bunch of land, and they had to write a giant check to the Soviets. Amazingly, the Finnish president, he was so appalled at having to sign this treaty. He said, "May the hand wither that signs this monstrous treaty." And in an incredible twist of history, he actually lost the power to use his hand within a month of signing the treaty. Absolutely amazing. But he signed this treaty, and as appalling as it was, it did allow Finland to keep their own system and to be capitalist. And by the and we go through, the story and the data in quite a bit of detail in terms of how much the comparing this the capitalist Finnish economy to the socialist Estonian economy. And so, by the end of the experiment, the Finns could afford, the average blue collar Finn could afford to buy twice as many eggs and flour and three times as much beef and sugar and cheese and milk and pork as the Estonian. They could buy four times as much sausage and herring and 17 times as much coffee. They had, more vacuum cleaners and twice as many cars and three times as many telephones and 20% more TVs. They were just so much more prosperous. So they have this example, and the Finns in particular, they have this real, close cultural affinity to the Estonians. Once the wall fell, they were happy to share their expertise and their experience with the Finns, and they started investing in Finnish shops, or I'm sorry, with the Estonians, and they started investing in Estonian shops in Tallinn, and they started advising them on setting up businesses. And I think that was a big, influence, is there's that idea of the proof of concept. So kind of bringing it back to what I was saying earlier is, people in Michigan and New Mexico should look to other states in the United States that are freer and that have, successful reforms, because I do think that proof of concept ends up being really important.
Yeah, that's a great lesson for policymakers or for people who are interested in making policy change. It's always a strong argument to be able to point to another government or entity or population that's using a policy effectively It's a good case for making use of it in your wherever you live. So that's all the time we have for this podcast. Matt, thanks a lot for sharing your expertise and experience on these important historical events and helping us learn more about the Overton window and how to apply it.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure chatting with you.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.